Hi guys, it's Dr. Sadaf, and I would love for you to like and share this podcast and make sure you leave me a review. I'd love those 5 stars. So please, when you send me a review, please make sure to put the 5 stars in and to share the episode with somebody that you know that could really use it. And I would absolutely appreciate it. Also, if you're looking to schedule an appointment with me, make sure you go to my email and put your name on the email list. You will be the first to know when I open up my office in spring of 2024. It's drsadaf.com. And last but definitely not the least, September 16th to the 23rd, 2024, I will be hosting a retreat with Dr. Basma Ferris in Morocco. You will be getting yoga and coaching, and we'll be doing excursions and cooking and spa and hammam and all of that great stuff along with meditation. So make sure you don't miss out. Spots are limited. So go to the link in my bio in both Instagram and TikTok to make sure you register. Enjoy the show. I am an American board certified OBGYN, a mom, a Muslim, and I'm talking about sex. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast. Welcome to the Muslim Sex Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sadaf Lodi, and this episode is everything you need to know about vulvar conditions that can happen as we get older or that may be present and you may not be aware of. Before I get into it, the first thing I want to make very clear is that this is not any type of medical advice. So if you're having any questions about your health, make sure you go see your healthcare provider. And if you have any questions at all about your religion, make sure you speak with your friendly neighborhood religious leader. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast because I just happen to be a Muslim woman that talks about sex. So today I am super excited to have on with me Dr. Sarah Signa. Welcome, Dr. Signa.
Thank you. And, I'm so excited to be here.
And Dr. Signa, would you be so kind to introduce yourself to the listeners and the viewers that may not know who you are and where you're located?
Sure. So I'm Sarah Signa. I am a board certified OBGYN and an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. I've been around that area for a long time, ever since I was training. I'm almost what they call a lifer. So I've trained at GW for med school residency, and then I stayed on as faculty afterwards and have sort of cultivated a practice of vulvar dermatoses, vulvar pain, and other genitopelvic pain disorders during my time there, and have been really lucky to have amazing mentorship both in and outside of GW to create the SAGA Center, which is the Sexual Health and Gender Affirmation Center. And we are a growing team of obstetrics and gynecology providers who do pretty much the full spectrum of sex medicine, which is really exciting. And that includes gender-affirming care for those who are non-binary or trans.
That's great. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for all that you do. And so what I would like to get into today is a little bit more about the vulvar health. And I know that you are also, are you part of the organization called Tight-Lipped, or do you help, do you advise with them?
So I'm associated with a couple of different organizations. So Tight-Lipped is one of them. I'm on their medical advisory board and have been for the last year or so. And it's truly been an honor to be asked to be a part of that group and to be so closely involved with a grassroots patient-led advocacy organization that is so committed to both making awareness, right, creating awareness around these vulvar pain and genitopelvic pain conditions, but also really making change. I mean, the work that they have done in connecting providers across the country who otherwise, you know, as you know, being in the sex med community, it's hard to connect sometimes because we're so siloed in our own little parts of the country. And they've really worked to connect people, especially in academic centers, who otherwise didn't have the resources to start a center in their institution and help them get the mentorship from others like myself to help create those curricula and resources for their learners.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. So I know that you focus a lot of your practice on vulvar health. And so maybe you could just take us a little bit through what type of conditions you see and what type of symptoms patients may be feeling that are experiencing those conditions.
So we do pretty much the full spectrum of pain disorders. And I'm pretty proud to say that, you know, we can really be the starting point for people. And even if it's not something that we can physically treat ourselves as obstetrician to gynecologist, we can get somebody to the person who can in the majority of cases. So the kind of big overarching concepts that we're looking at pain related to hormonal changes. So that might be something like menopause. It might be something caused by the birth control pill or by a cancer diagnosis or treatment. Those are probably the most common things. There's also nerve disorders, and that might be a superficial nerve ending problem in the opening of the vagina called the vestibule, or it may be something that's actually further up along the nerve branch, like along the pudendal nerve or even in the spine. Again, we start getting other people involved when it involves things like the spine, because I am not a spine doctor. I did not train to do injections in the spinal spaces. So I enlist the help of spinal specialists who know how to do those things and who I can trust to believe my patient's pain and be committed to helping them with it. We also see a number of people who have muscular conditions, and it's not just pelvic floor dysfunction. We see a lot of folks who have history of hypermobility, or basically having joints that are too flexible to support the joint appropriately. And that's usually because the ligaments, something about the collagen or other parts of the ligaments are not strong enough to support that joint as they're moving it. And so the muscles in the area, in our case, the pelvic floor muscles, are taking over and overcompensating for that lack of support. And that means they're more tense all the time. We see a number of different varieties of these disorders and help people get in touch with resources to help them, their whole body, you know, not just their pelvic floor. We see a number of people who have a lot of medical trauma, sexual trauma, potentially just childhood adverse events that have affected how their body functions physiologically. And it's not always about sex. It's not always about the genitals per se, but many people will hold tension in their pelvic floor as a coping mechanism. Think about all of us that hold tension up in our neck, you know, and our upper back. Think about people who hold tension in their jaw, get TMJ or pain, you know, where they're clenching their jaw. All of these things are just parts of our body with muscles and bones, right? And we hold tension there. Same thing can be true for your pelvis. And then lastly, we see patients with vulvar dermatoses. That is a pretty significant part of our practice. I was lucky enough to train from Andrew Goldstein, who is one of the world experts in lichen sclerosus, but we see lichen planus, all sorts of things on the vulva, and treat those and work with our dermatology colleagues in the area as well. So I love kind of being this central hub for people in their sexual health, and being able to kind of source out to what other ancillary or specialist services do they need in order to get better. We do orgasm, we do arousal, we do desire, we do it all, and we're able to collaborate with people so patients really get the best care.
That's amazing. Wow, I didn't realize it was so all-encompassing, so that's fantastic. I mean, I don't know of too many centers that do that, so that is really amazing. And then, you know, to be supported and to be staffed to do all of that is really amazing. So do you have sex therapists there as well that you refer to, or are they?
I wish. That's the one. So, you know, working in an academic center, I love it because I'm surrounded by friends, which are helpers, right? These are people who can help me get patients what they need. That's the upside. The downside is we work in an insurance model, which for patients is great, right? They can afford the care. A lot of patients cannot afford to pay out of their pocket for, you know, a full cash pay situation. But what they can afford is a copay. right? And so they see me, but then if I need them to see a sex therapist, someone who is a psychotherapist with special training in sexual health issues, some of whom are specialized in working with patients whose religion kind of comes into that as part of that. So having that kind of language and cultural understanding is important. Many of those people cannot take insurance because insurance doesn't really reimburse for those services. So it's not possible for them to be in business, you know, and also take care of patients. So that's one area that I wish we had more access to. But we have people in the area who are amazing and work with patients when they can. And we have a number of people in the community who do take insurance and they at least have an understanding, even if they're not necessarily like sex therapists only, right? So they have an appreciation, they've taken some courses, they are trauma-informed, they understand the modalities of therapy that can help people with a history of trauma. So those are kind of the people we use to help get patients to some access to the mental health side of things.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. I just actually had Linda Weiner on, who wrote the book on Sensate Focus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was just actually on my podcast and we had a great conversation about that. But she, of course, is a sex therapist. And so we talked about how the mind is, and we all know that the brain is the biggest sexual organ. And so we had a great conversation surrounding that. So I'd like to actually get more into kind of the vulvar issues that you see and, you know, perhaps if patients that maybe, or people that may be listening to this podcast, you know, how would they know that there was something going on or if they were experiencing pain in their vulvar region, how would they know to, you know, what was right, what was wrong, what, you know, how do they even know?
So I think it comes down to two main things. So, and I think actually this applies to providers as well. So I hope everybody listening takes something from this. So I think one thing that as a society, we have sort of allowed to happen based on a lot of the history of gynecology, how it came about, the practices of people who pioneered a lot of this medicine, you know, back when slavery was still a problem, back when there were issues with how people were being used to advance medicine, meaning people being experimented on. I know many people know the name J. Marion Sims now. Like these are really important historical contexts for this conversation. When you think about it in this cultural context, the number one things that people do not do when they're thinking about vulvas, one, they do not look. And again, I said providers too, they do not look. And number two, they do not listen. They do not legitimize, right? And so patients can also take something from this. Have you ever looked at your vulva with a mirror? Have you ever looked? Have you taken a picture with your selfie camera to see, like, what does it look like? If we've never looked, we will never know. And I'm not saying that providers aren't down there doing pap smears and speculum exams for other reasons, childbirth. There's many reasons why the vulva presents itself to a provider, but are we really looking? Are we really noticing the changes that might be happening in vulvar architecture? Meaning, are the labia still looking like they're present? Or are they suddenly kind of disappearing or absorbing? Can you see the clitoris? Can you pull up the clitoral hood gently and see the glands of the clitoris? Can you see changes in the skin tone? Can you see changes in the texture of the skin? These kinds of things are often missed. I have patients who will see me and say, oh, my vulvas always look like this. And they've seen countless number of people because of different, you know, points at which they've interacted with medicine that's involved their vulva, and no one has said a word because we're not really looking and noticing. And then for patients, if you look at your vulva and you're like, I don't know if that's normal, you should ask. You know, unfortunately, we're at a place in healthcare where we really have to be our own best advocates. And we don't always have access to a specialist who's going to know exactly what the problem is. But if we can key our providers in, our primary care providers, our OBGYNs, our urologists, our dermatologists, anyone who's looking at your vulva for any reason, if you can key them into the point that this isn't normal for me, or I feel like this isn't normal, period, then they may clue in and be able to get you to the resource that you need. The second thing is listening and legitimizing. And I think that so many people are told, even kind of underlying messaging of pain is normal, and that pain is expected when it comes to vulva and the vagina. And we know that that's not true, but it's so internalized from just a lifetime of exposure to that kind of messaging from society that it becomes very easy to even delegitimize yourself. So for patients, if you have pain, that's not normal. Like, no one should be hurting. No one should be feeling pain with insertion. No one should be feeling pain with sitting. People shouldn't be, just the same as you shouldn't have pain with walking, talking, chewing, right? All of these are normal daily functions that we should be able to do without pain. And if there is pain, there's often something we can do to help. And from the provider standpoint, making sure that we're really legitimizing someone's pain and not coming back with the reaction of relax or just drink a glass of wine or, yeah, it's kind of normal to have pain, you know, like these kind of statements just reinforce what the patient has already been experiencing their whole life, which is messaging that their pain doesn't matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I think that so many physicians, right? And I think it just goes back to so many things, but a lot of physicians, a lot of OBGYNs are not really trained in sexual medicine. And I think that you don't really have to be trained in sexual medicine to know that there's something going on, that something doesn't look right. Mm-hmm. But I think that we tend to overlook. We are looking for what it is that we're we have in our mind, that whatever the problem is, right? So that's exactly what we're going to look for. And that's what we're going to find. So if we're going in for a pap smear, we're just going to look for the cervix, do the pap smear and get out. We're not really, you know, examining the vulva. We're not examining the clitoris. We're not doing a thorough exam. You know, we're just finding what we're looking for, really. And I think that's what the problem is.
I totally agree. And I see this, you know, it starts from the education, right? Which is why I'm so passionate about working in academics and teaching and making sure that we're creating a model for education for learners. Because if we haven't created, you know, in medicine, we like boxes, right? We like to create these little boxes and they're very neat and tidy because we are all anal retentive and love like organizing everything, right? And, you know, we create these boxes and then we take the patient and we find a box for them to fit in, right? That's like a lot of the algorithmic practice of medicine. And not everybody's going to fit the algorithm, right? We talk about patients falling off the algorithm because they're not fitting that kind of clinical picture that we expect. And then what do, right? So some people, it's like very challenging to get out of that mindset. But once you do, you realize the freedom of using your brain to really analyze the data that the patient is giving you, whether it's from the exam, the history, blood work, whatever it is, you can use that data and really come up with an individualized picture of what's happening. And if we don't have that freedom and we're just stuck in those boxes, you start to ignore information, whether it's intentional or not. The patient says something like, oh yeah, my mom had a problem with pain and had a surgery to remove her uterus, and it really never got better until she stopped having periods and was, you know, was menopausal. And you know, someone may just say, okay, yeah, mom had pain, had a hysterectomy, whatever. But if you really clue in, oh my gosh, mom had pain, didn't get better with a hysterectomy, but maybe it was something like endometriosis, right? That didn't get better until they went into menopause. So then all of a sudden you're like, okay, some of your symptoms actually do fit with endometriosis. Maybe you just present slightly atypical and you're not my patient in the endometriosis box, but maybe there's just a bigger box that fits more people that don't quite kind of fit all those criteria. And it suddenly makes it much easier to find answers for people.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's really important. What you state is that not trying to make people fit into boxes that we already have preconceived notions of where, you know, we think they should be or what we think they have. And then what that happens is that we're not listening to them anymore. We're just trying to, you know, make them fit what we think they have and then treat them based on that. Exactly. And I think that's how a lot of women get missed and their symptoms get overlooked. So you had mentioned about lichen sclerosis, and I know that that is a very common symptom and can happen to a lot of women. Perhaps you can just tell some of the listeners and the viewers what that may look like.
So lichen sclerosis is an autoimmune condition. It affects many people with vulvas. So, you know, some of the older studies looked at prevalence of 1 in 300, 1 in 700. That's really an underestimation. There's one other prevalence study from a general gynecology clinic with that was staffed by someone who is an expert in gynecology, Andrew Goldstein, and he found a 1 in 70 prevalence. And this is people who are coming for their annual PAPs, right? They're coming for routine GYN care. And he was seeing this so much more often because he was keyed in to some of those subtle signs. So what are those subtle signs? So things like hypopigmentation is a word that people may hear, but it basically means whitening or lightening of the skin. So it's from a loss of melanin. It's actually a common thing to be caused by inflammatory conditions. So you can also get loss of melanin from conditions like eczema, for example, that's untreated. You can get it from a burn, right? A scar. So anything where there's inflammation happening in the area can cause this to happen. But that is a hallmark of lichen sclerosus, particularly when it happens around the labia minora, up by the clitoral hood, and then down around the anus. So we often say it makes like a figure of eight pattern when it goes around both of those areas. And so that can be something to clue you in is kind of where the whitening or lightening is happening. Another thing to look for is tissue texture changes. And those texture changes are typically going to be thickening of the skin that results in inflexibility. So the skin can no longer stretch and kind of change shape as you're moving. That's walking, sitting, putting something in the vagina like a penis or a dildo or a vibrator or whatever it is. Suddenly the tissue's not flexible as much, right? And then that can cause tearing. So many people will interpret this as thinning. They're like, I'm tearing. My skin is so thin and fragile. Absolutely, it's fragile, but it's actually thick. And the reason I always bring that up is because when patients have lichen sclerosis, they're often told by providers who may not be as familiar with the condition that don't use too much steroids to treat this, because that's, you know, that is the first line treatment is topical steroids like clobetasol. Don't use too much steroids because it will thin your skin. But that is such a piece of misinformation because, in fact, their skin is thick. And using the clobetasol to counteract the thickening is not going to thin their skin. Rather, it's going to keep it at a normal thickness if you use it appropriately. Those are kind of the main things that people talk about. But there's differences in, you know, across the age stages. And I can talk about that, too, if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, sure, I'd love to hear that because I've seen some patients that, you know, in my practice that have had lichen sclerosis and nobody, you know, and they've had it for a long time because their skin is very, very pale and it's more prominent in those individuals that are, say, African-American, right? And all of a sudden it's, you know, completely white in that area. Yeah. And I'll ask them, has anyone ever told you that, you know, this may be lichen sclerosis? And they have no idea because nobody's ever talked to them about it. So I'd love to hear from you, you know, what are the different stages and, you know, what other things people should be looking out for?
So lichen sclerosis is something that affects all people with vulvas. So it's not just, you know, in medical school, we learned that it's bimodal, which means there's two different age populations that it's very common for, which is prepubescent girls. So girls before they've started having periods and then postmenopausal women. So people who are past that transition point where they've stopped having periods. The problem is both of those populations, prepubescent girls, postmenopausal women, they have low estrogen. Just that's a hallmark of their physiology, low estrogen. And we think that reproductive age people are actually just as likely to have this inherent problem with the skin. However, they're not presenting with the obvious symptoms because estrogen may be somewhat protective in keeping the inflammation from taking hold of the architecture and, you know, causing the scarring that results in some of the closing of the opening, labia changes, and covering over of the clitoris, which are some of the other features I didn't mention earlier. When we're talking about reproductive age people, they tend to present differently. So Dr. Jill Kraft and I published a paper along with several other collaborators, including an amazing resident, Elisa Smith, who we basically found through a survey on social media of reproductive age people with lichen sclerosis that there is a difference in how they present. They're not necessarily presenting with the classic itching and lightening of the skin. They're presenting more with tearing and other kind of discomfort symptoms on the skin that's just slightly different. And so I think we're also missing people because we're looking for this quote classic patient. Sure. That is, again, fits in a box, and we're missing it because we're not really asking the questions. The last thing I want to comment on is your comment about women who have, you know, more melanin in their skin. So African-American women, other people of color. And I am so passionate about this because when I first started at GW, you know, as an attending and really got the training to understand lichen sclerosis, I saw so many women who were Black, who were Latina, who were all these different cultures, Muslim, from different countries, from all over the world, who actually had lichen sclerosis, but had been told forever that they had vitiligo, a yeast infection, or nothing. And this amount of misdiagnosis is totally unacceptable. And it's a really, really clear representation of the racism in our education, right? Like, we're not teaching people to be able to recognize these things correctly. So it's another thing I'm really passionate about is whenever I give a lecture, I make sure that I include images of many different skin tones, especially talking about dermatoses or skin conditions, because that is crucial for giving people the tools for the pattern recognition in the variety of patients that they see.
Right. Well, that's fantastic. I'm glad you bring that up because definitely, you know, this is what with this specific patient that I had seen, she was told that it was vitiligo. And I had asked her if it was okay if I did a biopsy because I wanted to confirm if that was it. And it turns out it was lichen sclerosis. So, you know, to your point, I think that that's exactly what happens is that a lot of times, you know, their patients are brushed off and told, well, you know, it's just vitiligo because they may have signs of vitiligo on other parts of their body. And that's exactly what it is, but it actually is not. So glad you bring that up. So I know that there's also, you know, you mentioned about lichen sclerosis, but there's also lichen planus. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between those two?
It's a really good question. So lichen sclerosis is usually on the outside vulva. So we say it's on the keratinized skin, which basically means the skin that looks dry, right? The skin that's the same as the skin on your arm or your leg. Once you get into the opening of the vagina, where the vulva and vagina kind of meet, you get to the vestibule. That's kind of where lichen sclerosis doesn't really pass by anymore. So it doesn't really affect what we call the mucosal surfaces, which is like the inside of your cheek or the inside of your vagina. The lichen planus will. So lichen planus can affect the outside. There's several different types. Lichen planus is also an autoimmune skin condition, and it affects the skin by causing a variety of changes. So it can actually mimic lichen sclerosis and look like a thickening and white texture. It can also, or white color, I should say, it also can look like an ulceration. So it can look like a, you know, a erosion where basically there's areas of skin that don't have that same dry, normal skin texture on the outside. It looks red. It's very painful. It might be weeping. And there can be patches of it, or it can be in large areas, and it can be a combination of things as well. So lichen planus is a little bit more of a shapeshifter. It causes the same amount of scarring, inflammation, skin thickening and discomfort as lichen sclerosis. It also is very important to treat because it will actually go into the vagina. So that's where it's different from lichen sclerosis. It will extend into the vagina and it can cause scarring in the vagina, which can close it up, make it very difficult to, for example, do a pap smear. For example, use tampons while someone's having a period. It can make it very challenging to have sex. To do anything penetrative in the vagina. So it's very important if someone does get diagnosed that they're using some kind of vaginal dilation, whether it's with a dilator on a regular basis with their medication, which is usually a topical steroid or a calcineurin inhibitor, or having regular penetrative sex is another way to ensure that. So if someone's already having a lot of penetrative sex, then that's not something to worry about as much. They're obviously still treating it with the medications, but it's important to know the difference between these because they're both common. Lichen sclerosis, I think, a little bit more common than lichen planus. And it affects people in a way that is also long-term, right? So this is anatomy changes, right? Changes in people's anatomy. This is crucial. And lichen sclerosis in particular is what we call pre-malignant, which means it's precancerous. So you can get cancer that's caused by active lichen sclerosis that's not being treated. And that's why it's so important to treat. So the risk of lichen sclerosis causing cancer is about 6% or so, a couple different studies showing around that percent. The chance of vulvar cancer in the general population is less than 1%. So this is a big increase. We need to take it seriously, and we need to treat people appropriately. Lichen planus hasn't been shown to have as much of that precancerous tendency, but it is still important to treat for those anatomic change reasons.
Yeah. So would you say that lichen planus is also autoimmune, or is it not?
Yes. It is. Yeah. Also autoimmune.
Okay. And, you know, I'm wondering with lichen planus, as with any type of, you know, dermatoses, you always have to get a biopsy. You always have to figure out, you know, what exactly it is. But I'm wondering, you know, oftentimes you mentioned about ulcerations. And I'm wondering if it gets confused with other things that can cause ulcerations in the vulva and the vagina, right? Like I'm thinking about like, you know, chancres that might be in the vagina. What have you seen? Does it get confused? I mean, I'm sure it can get confusing.
Yes, yeah. It gets confused a lot. I'll have patients who come to me and they're on these like high doses of Valtrex, which is a medication used for genital herpes, because someone thinks it's either herpes or some other viral reason for having an ulcer, which is possible, right? Those are legitimate diagnoses and they're actually quite common. But when the medication isn't working, and the culture that you've done, right, because you should do a culture of the lesion if you're thinking it's herpes. If the culture or the viral PCR that you've done is negative, then let's like move away and think about something else. So I think making sure that we're really thinking critically about these diagnoses that we're more likely to lean towards because they're very common, we have to make sure we think critically about that before kind of leaning into that treatment when it's not working.
Yeah, of course. So are there any other vulvar dermatoses that you see often? So we mentioned lichen sclerosis, we talked about lichen planus. What other ones are common that you've seen?
The most common would probably be lichen simplex chronicus, which is different from lichen sclerosis. It's a chronic inflammatory condition that's not autoimmune. It's more of a reaction to an environmental trigger. So that could be a yeast infection that hasn't been treated well. It could be chronic moisture in the area. Like I'm thinking of my patients who have urinary incontinence, who are wearing pads or panty liners a lot, that a lot of that moisture sitting against the skin can be really challenging. I'm thinking of my swimmers who are in wet bathing suits all summer or all year round, potentially. Sometimes that can be very irritating and cause the skin to become kind of leathery and very stiff feeling, and gets very itchy. They can't help but scratch. In fact, many of my patients with lichen simplex chronicus will say, I try not to scratch and all day I'm okay, but then I wake up scratching in the night. So like unconsciously, they just have to scratch because it's so itchy. So that is very common. Sometimes we have to do a biopsy to make sure that that's all it is, right? That it's not one of these other conditions, depending on the other pieces of their picture. And it really is treated by, you know, first of all, treating the offending problem. So that's getting them out of the wet bathing suit in between tournaments and, you know, making sure that they're not sitting in a wet panty liner, wet pad, treating their incontinence appropriately, right? Making sure that they're not having incontinence in the first place to help prevent that, treating the yeast infection that might be causing a problem, and then using steroids, sometimes as strong as clobetasol, to help treat that inflammation. Because what happens is you get these inflammatory cells that usually will respond to an initial insult on the skin barrier. And they'll go in, they'll do cleanup, they'll fight whatever it is, but then they're going to start recruiting long-term soldiers to help fight the fight. And the long-term soldiers, lymphocytes, love to come in and set up camp. And they will sit there and cause little amounts of inflammation when they see things they don't like, and then maybe bigger bouts when things are more active. But it's hard to get rid of them because they're long-term campers. So to get those long-term campers to get out of there, we use the steroids over a long period of time. So I often tell patients, don't stop this, the steroid, until your symptoms are completely gone, and then continue it a little bit longer. We do it for a few more weeks and then we stop. So it can be a couple months of treatment with steroids before people are feeling totally better. And then the last thing is yeast infections. I see so much yeast on the skin. People get Diflucan to death, and you know, Diflucan is a great medication. I see that it doesn't always penetrate the skin as well. So some people really need a topical antifungal, something like nystatin powder, nystatin ointment, clotrimazole. You can use terconazole topically. There's lots of things to do to help with the external skin that will give you more long-term benefit.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I think that, you know, so many things can cause irritation of the vulvar region. And I think that's one thing, maybe we can just go over a little bit really quickly of what are the symptoms that a patient may have. So, you know, I would think that if for something that's been going on long-term, maybe perhaps they're experiencing pain or itching or discomfort. What are the symptoms that people usually come in with when you see them for something like this?
So it is pretty varied, but I would say that the most common concerns that people have are itch, pain, and honestly, stress levels. So, you know, when someone's having chronic issues with their vulva, there's not a lot of people that they can talk to. There's not a lot of people that they can confide in because it's a private area. Many people are taught that you don't talk about this. It's not something you complain about. And therefore, they're sitting there feeling hopeless, alone, not heard, and like there's no solution to help them when all of those things are totally untrue. And so a lot of my initial approach is really allowing the patient to tell their story, to feel heard, and then giving a lot of validation in that, yes, this is absolutely affecting your life. Your quality of life is affected by this condition. You can't sit for more than 30 minutes without pain. You can't have sex with your partner without pain. You're unable to perform daily activities without being interrupted by itching. Your discharge is soaking through your pants, right? Like these are like very embarrassing and very stigmatizing issues that people just can't talk to anyone about. And once they get validated that, yeah, I should get treatment for this problem, it makes everything so much easier in terms of being able to move forward, also emotionally, because I think there's a lot of emotional hurt that comes out of these conditions.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you going over the symptoms because I think that sometimes, you know, patients may be experiencing these things and, like you said, you know, are afraid to talk to anyone about it, or perhaps they think they're imagining it, or maybe they've been told that it's nothing and that it's just another yeast infection. Or like you said, maybe it's just, you know, it's just vitiligo, just, you know, no big deal, whatever. And that it's really important for them to know what it could be so that they can then advocate for themselves and get the help that they need. So I appreciate you going over those symptoms. Anything that you would like to say to patients or people that are listening to this podcast that may be experiencing any of these symptoms, anything, any pointers or pearls that you would like to leave them with?
Absolutely. So first thing is one thing that I say to my patients all the time. And it's that if you press on your arm and it doesn't hurt, right? It feels like normal. And then you press on somewhere on your vulva and it hurts or it feels uncomfortable or it doesn't feel the same, there's a problem. So many people will be saying, well, there's discomfort. It doesn't hurt. There's not pain, but it's discomfort. So if you're pressing on your arm, that's what it should feel like to press on your vulva. It shouldn't feel different. It might be more sensitive, but it shouldn't feel different. So I encourage anyone who's like, well, yeah, that one thing like feels a little off. Please press on your arm, then press on your vulva, compare it. And if it doesn't feel the same, think about seeing somebody because there might be some explanations and solutions for you. And then the book Sex Hurts, When Sex Hurts is what it's called, by Jill Kraft, Andrew Goldstein, and Carolyn Pukal. Great book for people who are kind of in the discovery mode of, I think I have a problem. I'm not sure exactly what it is. It's a great resource, especially for pain disorders, in figuring out some starting steps and also some language to help you advocate for yourself.
Absolutely. 100%. I have that book and I think it's a fantastic book and it's such an easy read. It's not, you don't have to be a medical person to be able to read that. It's in plain English. So super easy to read and understand. So thank you for bringing that up. And, you know, for people listening to this and thinking like, wow, Dr. Cigna is amazing. I would love to go see her. I'm having this issue. How can patients get in touch with you? How can they make an appointment? Where can they see you?
So the clinic is at GW, so you can call the GW Obstetrics and Gynecology Department, and the folks on the line know what we do, and they will usually take your information and send a request to our admin so that you can get scheduled into a consult visit. We typically do telehealth and then an in-person visit so that we can really spend time talking before we do an exam, which is really important. And I have myself, Dr. Michelinetti, who is amazing. I trained her myself and she has just taken off completely. She's a great sex med provider to see as well. And then Dr. Katie Dumas is our fellow who is almost done her fellowship. And we are hoping that she's going to join us next year, which is super exciting. So there'll be lots of people there to see and take care of you. And if, you know, we don't fall in your insurance network, or, you know, it's not easy for you to get to us physically, the ISWSH, ISSWSH.org provider network or provider directory is really helpful for finding people all over the country and all over the world who also have expertise in this kind of care.
Excellent. And if people want to follow you on social media, what's your social media handle?
Dr. Dr. Sarah Cigna. Very easy, simple, nothing fancy.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about all of these super important dermatoses and things and conditions that women can experience, but that no one talks about and no one even tells you about. And even I would say that a lot of OBGYNs are not that familiar with and do not know how to treat. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing and all the difference that you're making in women's lives. So thank you so much. And well, it's been real and really intimate here, and I am done. So remember, this is not meant to be any type of medical advice. If you're having any issues and need help, please go and speak with your healthcare provider and know that there is help, and you don't have to feel helpless. And until next time, this is the Muslim Sex Podcast. So thank you for listening to the podcast, and make sure you leave us a review, share and like the podcast. And if you leave me a review, I'd love to shout you out on social media. So be sure that you share it with all your friends. And thanks for listening.